So there I was, an 11-year-old, just started comprehensive school, Glenavon Comprehensive School in Port Talbot. And we used to have a music class with a very kindly white-haired man called Mr. Powell. And it was just the boys for some reason. I don't know why. I don't know what the girls were doing at the time. Obviously, they don't like music, girls. But there was all us boys, 11-year-olds, in the class. And Mr. Powell used to try and get us into classical music. And he would play a classical LP on his record player. And we had absolutely no interest whatsoever at the time. And because he sort of got annoyed with us for not being into it, he said, all right then, well, why don't one of you bring a record in next week? So there was a lad called Mark Hughes, and he came in the following week, and he brought a record by someone. And he put that record on, and it was by someone called Adam Ant. And it was an Adam and the Ants album. It was Kings of the Wild Frontier. And he played it, and whilst he was playing it, he got up on the desk in the classroom, and he stood on his desk, and Mr. Powell was going, now, Mark, come on, down from the desk now. And he wouldn't get down, and he started dancing on the desk, and one by one, we all got on top of our desks and started dancing to it until Mr. Powell, the kindly white-haired, gently talking, soft-spoken Mr. Powell, left the classroom, I think in disgust or fear, I'm not sure which, and all of us were on our desk. It was a moment of true rebellion and revolt inspired by the man sitting opposite me now, Mr. Adam Ant. Hello.
Hi, Michael, how are you?
I'm very, very well.
That's a good story.
It's like Dead Poets Society. That is the impact you had on us.
Oh, yeah. I've never heard one like that before.
Were you not aware of this in classrooms all around the country at that time?
Not really, no. I mean, I was just busy, you know, busy doing the shows and dreaming up the videos and getting work, really. But years later, you know, I do, obviously, like yourself, do a lot of interviews, and people say, oh, my first album was Kings, and I had the biggest problem there was trying to get the white stripe, and some of them would put, like, you know, Tippex and get an allergy rash and stuff like that.
I know, we had a few people. Well, Mark Hughes had the white stripe, because he came in school once with that. And there was also a guy in Baglan, in Port Talbot, where I come from, used to go to the local community disco, and one time he came in the full get-up, and I had never seen anything like it. He was extraordinary. It was like Ace Face in Quadrophenia when Sting does that. It was like the coolest thing I'd ever seen. You kind of defined charisma to me. At that age, when I watched you, it was like I suddenly understood what charisma was and what performance was. I mean, you weren't just singing songs, you were like performing them. I'd never really seen anyone do that before. They were like tour de force performances, each one. When did you first start getting into the idea of being a performer rather than a singer?
Well, initially I'd been an art student. I studied graphic design at Hornsey College of Art. And I was in a band called Bazooka Joe with my mate Danny Kleinman. And it was a sort of pub band, because it was the sort of pub rock era, you know, Ducks Deluxe and Dr. Feelgood and all that stuff happening. And I'd been watching a lot of performers, and I always loved live rock and roll. And so it was, but the choice was between doing the graphic design or doing the music. So it just kept, you know, becoming music. And then I saw the Sex Pistols' first show in 75 November, and I just thought, right, okay, this is simple, this is straightforward, I can do this. And I've never really thought about it, to be honest with you. I've never thought about where that's come from. It's just something happens when you get on the stage, and it was there.
What was the sort of stuff you were listening to when you were a teenager?
Well, would have been a lot of glam. Mm-hmm. I really loved Roxy Music, art school. I liked Brian Eno and Lou Reed, Bowie, Iggy, early on. But before that, I think, you know, growing up, my mum was a big music fan, so there was always music in the house. There was, you know, a lot of Sinatra, Tony Bennett, Johnny Mathis, and then we had a lady used to come and look after me in the afternoon. She was a beatnik, so she'd bring Tommy Steele, Marty Wilde, Gene Vincent, Eddie Cochran. So I had this all the, you know, it's so eclectic, the music I was listening to, and I think it's like a sponge-like mentality. It all kind of went in, and above all, I was the first TV generation of watching music. I remember watching the first ever Ready, Steady, Go, the first performance of the Rolling Stones in their suits on TV. So suddenly, I was in this fortunate position to actually see the music I was hearing. So
that's interesting, yeah. Okay. So your impressions of music came visually as well as absolutely. Through sound, which a lot of people, I guess, before that, it was just about listening on records.
Or you went to a theatre, an Odeon, to see them play live. There were not all the radio, there's nothing else. So very fortunate to be in that that period in history where you could see the music as well as hear it.
Now, like, going back now and listening to Kings of the Wild Frontier now, what really strikes me is how kind of complete the vision that you had at that time was. Like, the sound, the look, the attitude, the concept, the whole idea of the ants, and then that the kind of, you know, a Native American sound. And it's a real, like, it's a full vision that you had. How did you manage to get something that was so total?
Well, I think the answer to that is, there were 3 years of preparation for that, starting in 77, going through the punk thing, then the post-punk era, and doing live concerts. Out of that, I was experimenting with makeup, experimenting with different clothes. Each sort of year had a different look based around the kind of punk look. So the early stuff was very sort of S&M based, and that was my influence from artists like Alan Jones at art school. And so I was incorporating a lot of my art school visual into the music. And then I was wearing, you know, I was interested in the samurai, so I was wearing, like, kilts with trousers underneath and makeup, different types of makeup. But I went out with this, I met this, very fortunate to learn how to put makeup on, because I'd watched my girlfriend do it, and then I met this girl who worked for the Kabuki Theatre, and she showed me how to do the layers and layers of powder to get that look, that China look. So that was the basis of everything. So really, for me, when I look at Kings, it was really just, it's sort of serendipity. It's like, I decided at 79, I was doing a concert at the Electric Ballroom. I brought Dirk Wears White Socks out, the first Ants album, which took ages. I mean, no one wanted to sign us, so I had to produce it and everything. And I looked out on the audience, and it was just grey. By that time, punk, the whole spirit of it had become very nasty, violent, druggy and horror. And I just literally remember the moment, I'm not doing this anymore, and I finished the show. And then I thought, I'd never used colour, so I started to incorporate colour into it. And I just wanted to do heroic, the antithesis of what I think punk had become, sadly. So it was heroic, and I loved Native American society, spiritually and visually. Piracy, you know, the other great history buff. It was a kind of mutant. It's like trying to grow a rose out of four different beautiful roses, and I was ready, so.
Well, when you listen to it now, it's just such an exciting sound, I think. It's one of the kind of, when I first heard the song we're about to hear, it just excited me, and it excites me now just as much as it did then. So let's have a listen to Kings of the Wild Frontier. A new raw family of wild nobility. We are the family. A new raw family of wild nobility. We are the family. Julia Rich from Essex says, hello, Michael, enjoying the show. Two questions for Adamant. Who would he like to play him in his life story? She says, I can think of a great character actor for the part. I don't know who she's referring to there. And then the second question is, does he still dream about Diana Dawes?
Well, as far as playing me, I think you're capable of doing, you know, anything. But it's very important, I think, when someone's playing you, that A, it's an advantage if the artist is around.
Mm.
And gives the actor a chance to, you know, like the Ray Charles film.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's that there. And also the idea of someone singing. When I watch music films, I'm looking at the guitarist to see if they're playing the chords.
Yeah.
It's a slight thing, but obviously that's the actor's craft, that they bring that to it. Diana Dawes was a... They use the word icon, you know. This woman was a star. This woman walked into a room and everybody were, you know, the room lit up. And she was a lovely woman. And
she was in the Prince Charming video.
Fearless. And she walked onto the set. This is like our Marilyn Monroe. Mm. And I was very privileged to manage to... I met her. I went to have dinner with her. And the restaurant was... She walked in and it was... The whole restaurant was, like, looking at her. And she told me a few stories, some of which I can't repeat.
I bet she did.
But she was lovely. And then I showed her the storyboard and I told her what I wanted to do. I said, you know, you'll be walking down with a live panther down the thing, yeah, and you'll be doing... And she said, all right, then, I'll do it. And she just did it. So yeah. She was cash, but she was cool.
And she, I mean, you had a lot of different people who were sort of iconic British TV film people, weren't you, in
the
video?
Well, the
video.
Lovely, so late, great Graham Stark recently died. Wonderful, marvellous actor. He was...
Was it Goody Two-Shoes?
Yeah, he was so... Just... Now, these are people that I love anyway.
Hmm.
Dandy Nichols from Till Death Was Part. Lovely. And just so... it was just a privilege to have them on screen and to think that I managed to have... really the last great star, the last great sort of 50s, you know, sex goddess, if you like, Diana Dawes in something that was... She was very interested in life, very... It was not the trendy thing. She was a risk-taker and she had... fearless, you know, she just did this thing. She brought everything to the table and she just did it.
And this was all like pre-MTV. This was before kind of videos really kind of took off, wasn't it? I mean, I remember that the impact that those videos that you did, the Stand and Deliver and Prince Charming and Goody Two Shoes, I mean, they were huge events, these things. I mean, where did that come from? Where did you get the instinct to go, I'm going to really put my efforts into these videos?
Well, really, when, you know, to wait that long for a hit and then suddenly get a hit and suddenly pretty much the world's your oyster, you can do what you like. Well, I said... I was looking at the kind of movies that had been made. I grew up watching The Beatles, obviously, and Magical Mystery Tour, and they were really the forerunners of the kind of music film. And I thought, well, I want it to be like a story. So I'd done art school at Horns. I did a film course, and I'd made short films, but I'd learned to do storyboards. So I was able to take the lyric and illustrate the lyric. And so I just came up with a short story, how it would work. And then I worked with a very great guy, Mike Mansfield, who had he'd been directing since Billy Fury. This guy had done music TV and he knew how to shoot someone. And he just shot me. You have people who really know their craft and then you give them the storyboard and it was literally shot for shot. If you look at the storyboards of Goody Two Shoes, it's more or less what you see on the screen. So I was very lucky to have that.
And didn't you do that Stand and Deliver video all in one day?
Yeah, we did. Because these were enormously expensive at the time, because the standard thing at the label was, you know, a band in a room with a light bulb and a Venetian blind. That was the degree of the thing. So this was outdoors. We hired all the coaches from the Pinewood. So these were the ones that were used in all the Hammer horror films.
Oh, wow.
And jumping out of the trees. The glass window was sugar glass. And I said, look, I'll jump through it, right? You've got one shot. I'm not going to get hurt, am I? No. So I jumped through, cut me face. But that, just doing that, it was like I'd grown up watching Buccaneer films on a Sunday. I'm not Errol Flynn, and all my friends are in that there's like six Marines at the back doing a routine. There was my ex-wife there. There was the dogs there. I had all my mates there, and the hanging sequence, of course, got banned. Quite rightly, but that was the hangman was my bodyguard. So it was. You
know. I call it bedroom acting. Whenever I've had to do films like more actiony things like Underworld or Tron and stuff like that, I always think of it. This is exactly what I used to do when I was a kid in my bedroom. I pretend, like Best Deaths. Absolutely. Coming off the wall. You have your friends pretending to shoot you or blow you up or whatever, and all that kind of stuff. Love all that.
It's marvelous. I think didn't Olivier say acting's a child's game? I pretend I'm. You know, it's a beautiful. Children are the best actors. They really are. They got I'm a bird and they fly.
Yeah, that's it. It's off you go. Wonderful. That's the thing I think about all the the films that I've done that have the most CGI in them. So it's the most technologically advanced stuff, but because it's all CGI, you end up actually reacting to a man with a long stick with a cross on the end of it, because the other stuff is going to be in there later on.
I don't know how you do that. It must be very, very hard, but
it's very hard.
You do it well.
It is very hard.
You do it very well.
Thank you. Talk about art. I think maybe the hardest worker I've ever come across. I mean, at the beginning there, when you Kings of the Wild Frontier and then everything coming out after that, you just didn't stop, did you? You were working your butt off, as they
say. It was four videos, four singles, one album a year, a world tour, all the promotion for literally about 3 years solid, 11 days off. But I'd had 3 years of getting told, no, you're rubbish. And it's a very good, you get the chance and you think, this is happening now. And everyone's saying, what are you going to do when it's over and all this stuff? And, so basically, I suppose it's the longer they take you to get there, the longer you stay there. I really had this thing in my background. My grandfather's a Romani, so he was very, work was your integrity. And I just thought, I've got to work very hard here. I like work. I get paid for something I do for free anyway.
Now, Adamant is the Blue Black Hussar marrying the Gunner's daughter, which is possibly one of the greatest album titles of all time, I think. This came out last year, about a year ago now. And you've been touring with it. How's that all been going?
Yeah, well, it's basically, it was Del Segno starting from scratch. It's my own label. So that was an experience. And I've just been back on the road since mid-2010, done over 300 concerts, just getting the band together and playing. But it's a labour of love, doing vinyl, double gatefold sleeves, which is I did the opposite of what you should be doing if you want to make a living in it. But it's a great experience, and the character, the title, every single interview they ask me about the title, and that's never happened before. Usually it's, what's this called? But it's a theme, it's a story, really. The Blue Black Hussar is a character. Adamant is the Blue Black Hussar. And then marrying the Gunner's daughter is a naval term for punishment in the Navy, Royal Navy, because I'm very into Nelson and Royal Navy. So Adamant's the Blue Black Hussar. Marrying the Gunner's daughter. And the backstory was, I took my favourite album, which was King's. What would that character look like as a young buck then? What would he look like for, 25 years later, if he'd walked to Moscow with Napoleon's troops and come back? Because those guys did, and I love reading that. And so I had a bit of a theme there, I had a bit of a backstory. So, well, that was pretentious to some people. To me, it was absolutely, I couldn't make it.
That was the thing. Everything you did, everything you've always done has got a sense of history to it. There's a story, there's drama, it's theatrical. It's a complete package. It's fantastic.
I do love history, but I keep my eyes. I read all the papers I read every paper every day. I do a lot of collage work, so I've got more time to do that now. But I think, if you don't know where you've been, you don't know where you're going, in a way. And I just love that idea of, I'm aware of what's going on everywhere else, but I know what I don't want to do. I don't want to sound or look or perform like anyone else, as I think anybody tries to do. So to me, every album's a labour of love, and this one certainly is, because I'm paying for it.
Well, now you're going to be touring this coming year, from 28th of March, in Lowestoft, going dates through April, up to 19th of April, where there's a very special performance, at the Hammersmith Apollo, where you're going to do the entire Dirk Wears White Socks album.
Yeah, that's going to be two parts of the show. The first half will be Dirk in its original you know, track listing exactly as it was, and then the second half will be, you know, the hits and some tracks off the new album. But that's really happened as a result of the feedback over the years, you know, when you go and meet the fans, and they say, oh, some fans, you know, your age, it was maybe Kings, but the slightly older ones, it would be, you know, Dirk.
Mm.
Or the ones that got Kings immediately bought Dirk.
Yeah, which is what I did, yeah.
Dirk has really taken on, because when it came out, it was, you know, you know, it was not, let's say it wasn't received very well. And it's not that, but it's just I've been playing that stuff in the concerts I've been doing, and the response to some of the tracks is as much as if I did standard Live or Rent music or some of the better ones. It's really that feedback I've been getting, and I thought, you know something, this was a tough record, and even now it's quite scary to perform some of the tracks live because I've never done it.
Right.
They're very, very, very difficult songs, so I've got a good band and we're going to have a go, so that'll be special.
Well, that's going to be an exciting night.
Thank you very much.
I saw you on Jules Holland's show about a year ago, on the Hootenanny show, which was fantastic, and you played a song on that, which is from the new album, which I'm going to play now, and I'm going to say thank you so very much. This has been a very special moment for me to talk to you. So, Adam, thank you so much, and this is Vince Taylor.
Thank you very much.
Look back, the whole world was his stage. He never acted his age. A girl we called French Valerie gave a gold plate chain to me. Asked her who had given it her, an old flame called Vince Taylor. Oh. Oh, Johnny looked back and never looked back. Thinking the damn vain, never see his like again. Must have left his mark on me, even like by Morrissey. Uh-oh.
Adam Ant, ladies and gentlemen, come on. This is value. Come on. Stuart Little I'm not going to say anything about mice, says, hello, Michael, enjoying the show. While growing up in my stig in the early 80s, my then girlfriend loved Adamant, so obviously I hated him, while secretly buying and listening to his music. It was hard being young. Good times. Thank you, Stuart. From Joe Capon. On Twitter, says, I remember the desolation I felt when somebody nicked the Adamant pendant from the last copy of Looking magazine in W.H. Smith's. Still hurts. Oh, I bet. Hello, Michael. This is Rufus. A mate of mine directed Nick Moran as Adamant in a short, Ant Muzak. Rather good he was. Loving the show. Hello, Nick Moran, if you're out there. How are you doing?